the Financial Sense Lifetime Planning Program. Here's your host, Jim Poplava.
For the last couple of years, we've been warning individuals that we're heading for an energy crisis. It's a combination of geology, lack of investment, and bad politics. But what will that mean? It's not just higher gasoline prices and higher inflation, but maybe we won't be able to get the goods we want when we want them on time. That's the discussion for today's show. Joining me on the program from Peak Prosperity is Chris Martinson. And Chris, you and I have talked about peak oil before, and I think we got a lucky break in the last decade because American shale has been the most significant increase in oil production globally. It hasn't come from OPEC. It hasn't come from elsewhere. But I'm seeing signs of many of these shale fields that are starting to peak now, whether it's the Bakken, the Eagle Ford, and there's even talk that the Permian could be next. So I'd like to begin our discussion with that. I know that you had talked and warned people in your crash course about peak oil. Give us an update. Are you still following that theme? And what are you telling your subscribers?
Well, Jim, it's always good to be back with you. Yes, this is the most significant issue that I want to communicate to people. Energy is everything. If you think it through, it's not hard. You know, you can figure that out. But we've grown up, Jim, you and I, everybody listening to this, we grew up at one of the most energy abundant times in our species history. And so it's hard to see it sometimes, you know, like a fish has trouble detecting water, they say. So we've been surrounded by it, but the signs are everywhere that that era is over. And it doesn't mean it ends on Tuesday. It just means everything's different and in a big way. So this impacts our financial system, our economies, how things grow, don't grow, which jobs you should have. It literally touches every facet of life. And if I could shake more people awake, I would do that. And that's what I do in my daily work. I'm just trying to alert people to this one issue.
It seems like something that's impossible, because we were talking about this in the 00 decade. I can remember Matt Simmons when he came out with his book, Twilight in the Desert. And that's something that if you listen to the people that don't believe it, they go, look at these gazillion billion barrels of oil reserves in Saudi Arabia or the Middle East. And as you and I know, Chris, Saudi Arabia and a lot of these OPEC countries doubled and tripled their oil reserves overnight in the late 80s. And in the case of Saudi Arabia, their oil reserves never change, even though they produce 3 billion barrels a year. So, you know, there's all this talk, well, if we get in a crunch, well, Saudi Arabia would come to the rescue. They'll pump 12, 13 million barrels. I've never seen it happen. And I don't believe it will. Do you?
No. Listen, you know, there's a difference between production capacity and spare capacity. It gets wonky quick when you get into this space, but the details matter. So for a long time, Saudi Arabia said, hey, we have the capacity to produce 13 million barrels a day. But what they really meant by that was they could deliver 13 million barrels a day to the market, but that was out of storage and out of the ground, right? Then, you know, I just watched their actual out of the ground production like a hawk. They said they were going to dial it up to 11 million barrels a day. You know what? Surprisingly, they did that for 1 month, and now it's fallen all the way back off. And of course, now we just had the surprise OPEC cuts where they trimmed another 500,000 barrels off. So that 11 million barrels a day, I haven't even seen that sustained for, I would need to see it sustained, Jim, for, I don't know, 3-6 months before I believed it. I think they can get there temporarily, but I don't know, did you catch this? Do you remember there was this sotto voce moment where a bunch of world leaders at the G7 are coming out, and there's Macron, and he's a real cagey political animal. So he knows the cameras are running. He knows he's within earshot. He knows all of this. And he sidles up to Joe Biden and says a little too loudly, hey, listen, the Saudis, they tell me that they maybe could produce a little bit more, but not much more, maybe 150,000 barrels a day, but that's it. Right. So he was telling the world, without using the words peak oil, that Saudi Arabia is at its production capacity. And that should be top of the fold. Every newspaper, everybody should be talking about it. And it's literally not a topic of conversation here in the United States, at least in public.
You know, it's amazing that you have these leaders, Macron and others, that know that this exists. And Chris, we're going down this route. My own state is a good example. We're going to get rid of diesel trucks by 2030. We're going to get rid of gas engines by 2035. And we're all going to go electric. And yet we are destabilizing our grid. We're shutting down nuclear plants, nat gas plants, and we're going to wind and solar, which, you know, is intermittent. And we've seen this play out. Like last summer, we had power outages, and the governor's saying, do not charge your EV from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. Well, Chris, what are we going to do when we're all driving EVs, which don't work everywhere?
You know, I'm going to be as kind as I can. This is not an adult-sized plan, okay? This is just not reasonable. It's not rational. It's what happens when you delude yourself and you tell yourself comforting lies for a long time, and a whole crew of people grow up believing those lies, right? And I see it all the time. You do too, right? Wind is now cheaper than coal, they say. Well, no, it's really not. And it's not even close. Not when you take the intermittency into account. Not when you figure out that these things actually have to be replaced. Not when you look at the actual mining costs and damage that's done when you have to take out however many billions of tons of earth to get the materials you need, on and on and on. It's not credible. But here's the hard part about this, Jim, you know this, right? Whenever somebody does dive in and they say, oh, how would we replace, you know, meaningful component of our fossil fuels by other means? There's a lot of things it impacts really quickly. It's that we had 200 years of growing up around coal, then oil, then natural gas. And people think we're just going to undo that in a couple of decades. We'll just pass laws. By 2035, no more internal combustion engines because we said so, right? It's mind-numbingly stupid. But it's ignorant. It's beyond stupid. It's really ignorant about how markets work, how industries develop, how long it takes to shift from one thing to the other. These are people mostly, Jim, who are passing these laws or thinking these ideas, who have never actually owned a productive business. They haven't had to take wood and turn it into a house, or a lump of metal into a machined part, or wrestled something out of the ground that didn't want to come out, right? So it's I'm telling you, we're heading for disaster on this. But you know who isn't? China. It's amazing how they get it. They understand it. They're forging relationships. They're putting in the infrastructure. They're very clear-eyed about what solar and wind can do and what they can't do. Important, but not central, right? So they get it. We don't. So that's if you want to know where everything's going, you have to look at, you mentioned three things, and one of them was political decisions. That's actually, I think, the most harmful of this whole story.
You know, it's amazing. As you say, they get it. They're building natural gas plants. They're building coal-fired plants. They are aligning themselves with strategic alliances with major commodity producers. So we want to go green. Green takes rare earths, and they almost have a monopoly on it. They're almost like the OPEC of rare earths. And Chris, good luck trying to open up a copper mine, cobalt mine here in the U.S. You can't. So we're increasingly relying on China for our solar panels. We're relying on them for strategic minerals, whether it's rare earths or others. How's this going to work? As you mentioned, the biggest issue here is bad policy.
Well, it is. And it's just not rooted in anything reasonable or adult-sized. You know, when I listen to Jennifer Granholm, who is the current director of the Energy Information Agency in U.S., right, Department of Energy, she's clearly quite ignorant about what energy is, how it works, how these things work. I forget what her last job was, but I think she was like a lawyer or teacher. I forget what she was, but out of Wisconsin, she was a politician, career type. Not that those people can't learn into those roles, but she has displayed no acumen for this particular area. Right now, when I wander over, you come with me sometime, I'm sure you've done the same thing. You talk to people who are in the business, right? These are the guys and gals who are drilling the holes in the ground. And you ask them what's going on. You talk to the CEOs of these shale companies, and they are clear as can be. There's only so much of this stuff in the ground. It's getting harder and harder to find. And we can see the end of it in not too many years out in the future. And by end, I mean not the physical, literal, there's no more. But no matter how much we want to, we won't be able to expand production. It'll start to slowly tail off for one of the other three things you mentioned, which is just geology.
The amazing thing about that is when we get to that peak, its implications for economic growth, because politicians are always saying, hey, my policies are creating growth, the Fed's lowering interest rates, and you know, we're going to see this economic recovery. Well, you have to have energy to do that. Energy gives us machines. If we look at our modern life today, all the tech stuff we have, from our iPads to our iWatches to iPhones and all these other things, it takes raw materials. It takes energy to produce these things. I mean, you can't build buildings, these skyscrapers that we see in cities. They're all made possible because machines run on fossil fuels.
They do, and in particular, anything we want to do in terms of growth comes from what we call net or surplus energy, right? You have to have the surplus. So whatever energy you need to go out and get more energy, you know, that's embedded in that. And then you have some surplus you can do something with. So you know this, and I'm sure many of your listeners do, but maybe it's time for a refresher, which is the whole concept of energy return on energy invested, EROEI. You know, the EROI, you said it as a word. That's really a central concept. And so even though it's true, people go, oh, look, reserves of oil today are about what they were 10 years ago. Therefore, peak oil is wrong. Well, that's not good logic. What we're finding is that all the stuff that we drilled and found and discovered in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, that's really high, tasty EROI stuff. It's still there. The Ghawar field in Saudi Arabia has been pumping out since, I don't know, the 50s, right? 40s. That's a monster. Best field in the whole world, you know, number one. It's still pumping. So that's super cheap oil. But we need more, right? So now we're drilling down into, say, the Bakken. Hey, there's oil there, but it's really not the same at all because, you know, this is shale oil. You got to drill down 10,000 feet, tip the drill bit sideways, go sideways another 10,000 feet maybe, frack the whole thing, and it flows for maybe 3 years before it's 85% wound down, right? The wells in Ghawar, some of them are still flowing, Jim, 3,000 barrels a day from a well that was drilled in the 50s. It's astonishing, right? So not comparable. So that's the thing that's really missing from this conversation. I wish we had more adults in the room saying, you know, somebody at the EIA with their multi-billion dollar budget, they ought to be sitting down and saying, okay, we really think we want to go green. All right, gosh, bust out a napkin and a crayon. How much copper is that going to mean? How much lithium is implied by this? Like, how much stuff do we need? Where does it come from? Inside the United States, outside the United States. Oh, who are we in competition for with that? That's just on the resource side. And then they have to answer, how do we store this and how do we move it around? So that has a bunch of implications. But the biggest part is we ought to be running the calculation to say, hey, we're living on stuff with an energy return on energy invested from fossil fuels that's measured somewhere between 20 and 100. It's really awesome. We're going to replace that with something with an energy return of what? 2, 3, 4, 5? Totally different equation. What does that mean? Not having those conversations. We're just going to legislate away all the internal combustion engines by 2035. Trust us, it's going to be great.
You look at that. I had a friend that was visiting here from back east, and he said, I've never seen so many Teslas as he has in California, because you pull in the parking lot, you're on the freeway, you see Teslas all over the place. They do work in sunny weather, but I have a funny story that explains their limitations. I had a friend, of course, we've been getting all these snow and rainstorms in California here for the last 2 or 3 months. He was on a freeway driving north to get back home in Northern California, Chris. They were stuck in a freeway jam because of the snow and the weather. But one of the things that was jamming the freeways were Teslas, whose batteries went dead. Because when they designed the Tesla, they talk about mileage on a battery charge. They don't talk about what happens to your battery when you're stuck 4 hours in traffic.
And you need to run the heater. They're just not designed for that. Yeah, and all batteries, chemistry-based batteries, perform badly. The colder it gets, the worse they do, right? So yes, they're just not designed for that. Quick story. Last time I was in Beijing, and you look around, I've seen the future. And they have electric cars and vehicles everywhere. But they aren't these monstrous, you know, Tesla's an amazing thing. They're literally sports cars, right? Like 30 years ago, no matter what you wanted to buy, no matter how much money, Tesla could probably beat it, you know, in terms of performance. They're amazing. China isn't taking that route. They're like, listen, we need little things. They have electric scooters, electric three-wheeled things, little tiny electric cars for that purpose, for just scooting around, larger electric things for maybe distributing things. And that's what the future would look like. So if people said, hey, I really believe in this electric future, but they default to just like, oh, look, Teslas, it's this cartoonish version of the future where instead you would be, you know, just like China's being, I think, very thoughtful. And you say, wow, we only need a little thing. that's not a, you know, monster, you know, 300 horsepower sort of rig to move this person from this side of the city to that side, or to move these carrots from here to there. So that level, if we were pursuing that, I would feel differently. But if we were doing this properly as a country, we'd be all in on nuclear, and we'd be building nuclear plants, not decommissioning them. We'd be figuring out where we were going to get our nuclear material from going forward, because there's a story there. We'd be figuring out how to create this electric network with appropriately sized electric vehicles. And then I'd go, okay, all right, there's a story there. But like you started out with this idea that like, oh, we'll just make everybody get Teslas, but then we'll have to legislate when they can and can't charge them because we accidentally were stupid about our power plants. The whole thing, it just doesn't, it's not a plan yet. That's what we're getting at here, right? It's like, I feel like we're thrashing about a little bit. And it's because our leaders are not well-versed in, let's just call it physics.
And that's the issue. You know, they think by legislative fiat, we just make this pronouncement, we'll be done with diesel by 2030, gas cars by 2035, and it's going to happen. And you just think of the amount of charging stations. The other thing I was reading a book by this lady, ran one of the largest shipping companies in the United States. And she was talking about, like, Chris, trains, we've lost about 2/3 of our train tracks after World War II, as we shifted from trains and boats for transportation to the interstate freeway system and cars. And trains are more efficient in terms of transporting goods per, let's say, gallon of diesel fuel. So, you know, when we're talking about the limitation of fuels, you're talking about redoing your transportation system. We're probably going to have to rely more on trains. We're going to have to rely more on boats, river barges, things like that to transport goods. And one company that seems to get it is Toyota. They're going with hybrids more than they are EVs, as they believe they can make 4 hybrid cars to every 1 EV. And that's where we should be going, because a hybrid will work in cold weather. An EV won't.
I totally agree. The hybrid makes a ton of sense because most of your travel is local. So guess what? You're mostly on the electric part of that story for that. Then if you need to go longer range, well, that's where the hybrid part kicks in and the internal combustion takes over and helps you get there. To try and do all those things in just an electric package is a very tall engineering order, right? Because if it has to go 300 miles, you've got this giant battery pack, right? And because it's so big, it's heavy, and you have to cart it around when most of your travel is just a few miles, right? So those things, I agree with Toyota on that. And as well, I mean, come on, we've seen all the train derailments lately. It's not just that you have something, it's how you maintain it. And so we have a huge deficit here of not maintaining our infrastructure in the United States. Anybody who travels overseas and rides one of those new high-speed trains that you can find in Europe or China or Japan, they're wonderful. And if I had that option, Jim, I would take those all day long. Like if I go to DC, which is an 8-hour drive, it's a painful hour flight because it takes so many hours to get through airports, parking and security and yada, yada. But if I had a train I could get on and whisk down there in a reasonable time, I would do it all day long, like lots of people would, but we don't have that.
Well, let's talk about, given that we see this scenario, I see this major energy crisis, and I think it's also going to play out in the financial markets, Chris, because the inflation rate has been coming down and everybody, the markets are getting giddy again. Oh, gosh, the Fed will be cutting interest rates. That's a Wall Street dream for liquidity. But what happens if oil prices start heading up later on this year? What happens if the dollar continues to decline, which means the things we import into this country get more expensive? And if energy prices go up, let's say we get back up to $1,900 a barrel, what does that mean? Higher gasoline prices, higher diesel prices, which gets translated into higher goods, which means higher inflation.
Yeah, so there's two components to inflation. I mean, it's everywhere and always a monetary phenomenon, not the price is a symptom. But sometimes prices rise because of inflation, and sometimes they rise because you have a legit supply-demand problem. I think we're going to get into a legit supply-demand problem with oil. I've been talking about it with my subscribers for a long time. I track it like a hawk, because that's the kind of price increase that the Fed can't do anything about. raise rates, lower rates, shovel money to your Wall Street friends, do whatever you want, right? And it won't matter if we have a shortfall in oil. So wander with me over to OPEC's recent decision. They just took 1 million barrels, 1.6 actually, if you include Russia, which isn't an official member, but we're down 1.6 million barrels a day of production. China is busy. They just had their second highest import month last month of oil. They seem to be back online and they're importing more and more and more. And I can easily see, so you mentioned three things. This is also very important. Huge lack of investment in upstream oil and gas exploration over the past, not just few years, but it's going on like 7-8 years now, right? Since that collapse in 2015. Probably about $2 trillion missing investment so far. Oil companies have got religion and they're busy shoveling money back to shareholders, which is totally fiduciary responsible. I get it. But we are not, it's so easy to calculate that we're going to have a pretty giant oil shortfall and it's going to last for a long time. Same story around copper. There's just certain things we have where we're going to have shortfalls. Those translate into higher prices. When you get a higher price in oil, everything that's a derivative of oil, which is almost everything, goes up in sympathy with a little lag. Food prices go up, but eventually, you know, rents go up. Everything sort of follows along. So I think we're going to be facing structural price increases in oil. We could call it inflation, but it's not. It's due to a profound failure to invest in itself. We have to chase back to, again, the Fed. Remember what they did in 2000? They gave us 1%, 0% yields. So people had to yield chase. And one of the areas they yield chased in was the shale space. So the United States went out, flooded the world with oil, and that collapsed the price, which then ultimately is going to lead to a supply shortfall because with collapsed price, you don't get all this discovery. I don't know if you might want to look at this, but look at the stock prices for the offshore oil drillers, the big ones. They are just crushed. You know why? Nobody can drill offshore at less than 100, 110 a barrel. Nobody. So it doesn't happen. That's the nuclear baseload, though. When you get your offshore, your big offshore finds, Jim, those are the ones that, you know, you get that field, they're big, they play out for a decade, super consistent flow rates. That's your baseload for this, big conventional fields. Well, even if tonight, Jim, we woke up, got religion, said, you know, we really need that offshore drilling. Let's do it. The government will throw money at it to make it happen. Well, when you talk to the people in the business, it's the same old story. A lot of gray hairs in there. They've aged out. Young kids aren't going into the field. So we have a labor and an experience shortfall there. That's just going to take time to develop. And these were all foreseeable things. You wrote about it. I wrote about it. I mean, it's pretty obvious. So I don't know how this shakes out, except to say people need to just be prepared for much higher oil prices and everything that entails.
Yeah, we've been telling and urging people, if you're going to get a car, get hybrids now. Why? They're still affordable. Because when we start getting, Chris, we're up at almost $6 gasoline, and we've got oil prices at a little over $80 a barrel. Imagine what California, we went from 43 refiners down to 15. And now we just put in a price cap on their refinery margins. California, instead of drill, imports most of its oil from Saudi Arabia. So what happens when the price of the dollar goes down or Saudi Arabia looks for another currency? So, you know, our politicians aren't thinking this through. But what are some practical things people can do? For example, my house is run by solar. I have solar panels. But Chris, it doesn't do me any good because I'm tied into the grid. So if we have power outs, as we did last summer, you know, my power goes out too. So I'm going to have to put in batteries for backup. I was going to do natural gas, but our natural gas prices are up over 150% over the last year.
Oh, yeah. So practically speaking, here's how we get ready for higher energy prices. And it is coming, by the way. And I even think natural gas is going to be, United States is just brilliantly blessed with resources. Natural gas is one of them. And we're also going to be shipping a lot of that over to Europe, tightening our own local supply. So we'll see prices generally higher. Listen, anything you can do, a couple things. First, just make sure that your home is well insulated, that you have a car that's really efficient, like you're mentioning the hybrids. That way you at least have sort of a dual fuel way of approaching this if you had to. you know, if the grid was really unstable for whatever reason in your area, Jim, you could figure it. You'll figure it out. You'll figure out how to take those wonderful solar panels and get the electricity out of that where you need it. Beyond that, I have real concerns that our financial system is really only geared for growth. That's what I talk about in the crash course. I combine our financial model, which is really a monetary model, right? Which is based on, hey, we're just going to continually expand credit forever, right? And we've been doing that, what, 60, 70 years now? So if that doesn't work out anymore, if all of a sudden a number of people wake up and peer into the future and go, oh, growth is over. This is the biggest, most profound question for somebody with financial wealth is, what is the appropriate price earnings ratio for a stock market that can't grow? Or how much is a $92 trillion bond market, which is the total amount of debt in the U.S., bond and debts and loans, how much is $92 trillion of debt worth if the future is smaller, not bigger? The answers are to both those is less. We don't know how much less. And obviously, in nominal terms, it could go up still because the Fed's going to print. But, you know, when you really look through this, you have to be ready for a couple things. The Fed, of course, is going to try and print their way out. There's not a chance in the world they're going to willingly allow this to go down the deflationary path. There's too much stored energy there. It wrecks too many things, and it won't happen. So they'll print. At the same time, you have to now begin to realistically factor in that the United States is no longer a unipolar power in the world. China's moves in the last just 2 months have been just absolutely head-turning for me. I'm still trying to make sense of them. They brokered peace between Iran and Saudi Arabia. They did what? Peace, you know, China brings peace to the Middle East was not something I thought I'd be saying, right? But there it is. And they're cutting all sorts of bilateral non-dollar-based trade agreements, you know, in Brazil for reals versus yuan. Russia is now conducting more trade in yuan than dollars. It's just astonishing how fast. So in the past, the Federal Reserve, you know, they could print. Everybody had to sort of just suck it up internationally. That may not be the case anymore. And at least fractures into the BRICS versus, we'll call them the Five Eyes, right? You know, United States, Australia, Canada, Europe, right? So that's a different world. And I think the era of the Fed being able to do whatever it wants is over. I think it's going to be a whole different world. And that's why, you know, the death of the petrodollar won't be instant, but it's happening. We saw that Saudi Arabia has already said that they're going to give preferred discounts and trade volumes to China. China's sucking all that up. China's been on this path for years. Belt and Road Initiative is fundamentally about gaining access to these things that they need, the resources they need, without having to compete with the United States with a blue water navy, right? Much cheaper to build, you know, on the road, on land. So that's the world we're in. It's changing really, really fast. What do people need to be ready to do? Well, pivot, adjust quickly, think what you know, but test it against the reality and be ready to pivot. But if I had to just give, you know, if you said, Chris, that's too long, one thing, what do they do? Hard assets. That's the only thing that makes sense to me here.
Yeah. I mean, when you take a look at what really struck me is in the last 3 years, we added $9.5 trillion in debt. And to put that into perspective, Chris, it took 250 years of American history in 43 American presidents to get up to our first $9.5 trillion. We just did it in 3 years. And we're adding trillions of new dollars of debt. And that's why this idea that the only way they're going to be able to control this is for the Fed to come in and do yield curve control and start monetizing some of this. Because if you take a look at, we follow the Treasury market. I mean, I'm taking a look at the Treasuries that are coming due. And we're going from 0.5% on 10-year treasuries. We're over 3 now. If you look at T-bills, they've gone from nothing to almost close to 5%. What does that mean when you have almost $32 trillion in debt? The government's going to end up paying more in interest. We're almost approaching, in the next couple of years, we're going to be paying $1 trillion a year annually just in interest.
Well, we could. And there's a number of things sort of weighing on that as well. This past year for 2022, but it just came into law and it was affected in January of 23, was an 8.7% cost of living adjustment, a COLA. That 8.7% is coming ripping right out of, you know, the entitlements. The entitlements are now hemorrhaging. Those used to be a cash cow feeding into the general obligation fund positive cash flows. They're now negative. And they talk about, oh, hey, you know, even the CBO has come out and said, you know, looks like the Social Security is bankrupt by 2033, which is true. It's actually bankrupt today. You know, it has no, in the sense that it has no money in the bank. But somewhere between here and there, you know, the United States is going to have to make a big adjustment to that and either, you know, shaft retirees or existing workers or both in some combination. But it's broke, right? So we have that. Huge cash demands on that. Obviously, we're spending like drunken sailors. And there's the entirely realistic prospect now. We are everything except by law at war with Russia right now, right? You saw those documents that got released and they showed that we're up to our eyeballs. We're planning everything. We got naval assets over there. We got, you know, satellites. We got boots on the ground. We got weapon systems, training, everything but Congress, you know, manning up and declaring we're at war, right? So if that gets a little hotter or more expensive, that'll be weighing on a lot of things as well. So when you put all of that together, it's very clear that people have to begin taking, I think, a fairly proactive and defensive stance against what's going to come. Because, you know, I could be wrong, Jim, but my sense is we're going to see more dumb decisions out of the Federal Reserve, which hasn't seemed to manage to find a good decision in my adult lifetime. It's just bailout, bailout, print more, act like this is normal, and it's all going to carry on. But I don't see how we get from here to 2030 without it, something breaking.
Yeah, whether it's the dollar, whether it's on the energy front with no economic growth. And, you know, the implications of something that's more ominous when you look at that, Chris, is how do you pay that debt off when you have no economic growth? How do you pay that debt off if you have economic contraction? Nobody's thinking through, at least not Wall Street.
That seems really obvious to me, right? It's a good question. We should be asking that. And I guess everybody has such a tiny slice of it, they don't look at the whole, but it's a great question. How do you pay that back under a world of persistent economic contraction? And the answer is you don't. Well, do you let the whole thing collapse or do you try and print your way out of it? You try printing, right? AKA, we call that Venezuela, Zimbabwe. It's been tried over and over again. This is a very old motif in human history, right? And the one way you avoid that, and this is always tricky, is you have to get out of the mindset of thinking about things in terms of your currency. And you have to start thinking about the value of things, right? So I try not to hold dollars. I'm still holding them now because I think there's a crash coming and yeah, I can buy stuff cheaper. But for the most part, I'm oversteered into hard assets. I like land. I like trees. I like gold. I like silver. I like nickel. I like copper. I like uranium. These are things that are tangible. I get them. I understand the value and they make sense to me.
You know, the other thing, when you talk about hard assets, and I'm a big believer in hard assets as well, and especially one of my favorites right now, Chris, is silver. And what really strikes me about the silver market, we've been monitoring the COMEX warehouses, and silver is literally flying out the doors. I don't know how they keep this suppressed as well as they do. But Chris, there's almost 20 ounces of silver short for every 1 ounce available, to me, which is criminal. Because imagine, if, for example, I wanted to short, I don't know, Google, and I was allowed to short 20 times the amount of available Google stock. What do you think I would do to Google stock?
You crush it.
Yeah, but yet they do that. And I think there is a reckoning day coming to the COMEX where you allow these leveraged positions, short positions, when there's actually not enough metal to fulfill those obligations. God forbid, they have an escape clause where they can just settle for cash instead of the metal. And so that sort of protects them in one way. But think about the credibility. If you go out and you buy, let's just say you're a manufacturer, you need silver for whatever you're making, maybe a high-tech item or something. So you're buying these contracts thinking you're going to get delivery. What happens when there is no delivery?
A bird in the hand. It's worth two in the bush. So, I'm a big student of things, and I think we already have our answer, and I'm sure you caught it. But the London Metal Exchange told us exactly what's going to happen. They have a number of metals over there. Nickel is one of them. And they had one big Chinese firm who they decided to protect who was short nickel. There were a bunch of people who correctly read that the market was not what it needed to be, and they were long. And then there was a big giant spike in the price of nickel as the shorts tried to get out from under it. Yeah, they couldn't. So what did the LME do? They wrote in, and you said, you know, they can always settle for cash, but they can also do one more thing, which is they can just break the rules. And that's what they did. They actually settled for, if nickel went from, say, 10 to 100, they just settled it back at 10, right? They just broke the contracts, 5,903 contracts. They broke them and told the people, yeah, you can get your cash back, but it's not even remotely what you would have made, you know, and what you did make. And then they tried to pretend like the whole thing was just normal. And then just funnily later, we found out that JP Morgan's a proud owner of a bunch of nickel in the warehouse, which turned out to be rocks in a bag. So JP Morgan owns a bag of rocks, a bunch of them. How does that even happen, right? These are smoke signals going off on the landscape that tell you, you don't own anything unless you actually have it in your hand. So my strongest advice to people always is you want to get the physical silver or gold or whatever it is you're talking about. You need to own that because we know that they will both rig the system, and then when it goes against them, they'll change the rules.
Chris, I'd like to get your comments because we're both hard money advocates owning hard assets. But if you take a look at the price of silver, which they knocked down today, it was over 26. It's back down to 25 something. If you take a look at that price where they're hammering gold and silver today, once again, coming in with huge short positions, but try going to Kitco or some bullion dealer and buy a silver eagle, you're going to pay a 60. I've seen premiums at one time as high as 80% over spot. How do you explain that?
There's a fake market and a real market. So the paper markets are fake, right? And we know that, right? I mean, if you can short 20 times the actual thing, it's not a real market anymore. It's a casino, and it's a facsimile, but it has no bearing on anything. So, you know, when I want to know the other day I was doing this with somebody, one of my subscribers, and they said, you know, I want to buy some junk silver. I was like, oh, okay, so let's go. We go to all these different websites, right? All the biggies, Atmex, JD, you know, SM, all these big websites. And they all said, here's the price for silver, for junk silver. We just don't have any out of stock everywhere, right? But here's the price. And I was shocked anyway, because I remember my first bucket of silver, you know, those big heavy ones, this with $1,000 face value, they're, I don't know, 60 pounds, right? They're a load. I think I paid maybe $5,500 for my first one. And they were quoting out $31,000. For one of these, but they didn't have any. So that means it's not a market even there, because in a market, you find the clearing price. So now then I wander over to eBay, like, well, and people are buying and selling junk silver over there, but there was a market clearing. There were people who had some and people were buying. The effective price per ounce of silver on eBay as of last week was $49.95 an ounce for junk silver. Now, a bunch of lessons we could draw from that. First, for some reason, people have a strong demand for what used to be called junk silver. We're going to have to call it premium silver now. And I think that's because they're recognizing that this is a recognizable form of tender. And maybe they're thinking about it like I am, or maybe you, that, oh, I would like to have some silver that people can instantly recognize as money, right? An off-brand silver round, you got some explaining to do, right? But how does that even happen? That at that day, when I looked that up, silver was allegedly worth 25 an ounce, according to COMEX, but on eBay, it was $49.95. That's a huge spread. And so that tells me that the market is in the process of breaking down. That is a broken market.
I couldn't agree with more. And the simple thing that they're allowing, let's say, somewhere of 20 ounces short for every one available, that's criminal. Because obviously, even if 5 or 10% of the people that want to take delivery, they don't have it to deliver, and you see what's happening. And Chris, I wonder if this accounts for in Asia, China, and some other countries are thinking of coming up with their own exchanges to compete with New York and London, because they see it's rigged.
Not just rigged, but so to me, the seminal event, the one thing that actually changed all of everything, there was no going back. This is probably one of the worst political blunders of my lifetime, and there's been some doozies, was Joe Biden's administration freezing the sovereign reserves of the Russian National Bank on February 25th, 2022, post-invasion. Well, that was a big deal because it said that Russia's sovereign reserves were neither sovereign nor reserves. And that was a really big step. I think it was done sort of reflexively and without a lot of thought. Certainly one thing that seems to be a blind spot, shall we say, a shortcoming of the Biden team is their ability to understand cause and effect, right? You know, incentives, outcomes. It's just a broken they don't get the connection, right? So I think they thought they could just sort of teach Russia a lesson, but unfortunately, they taught the whole world a lesson, which was you can't rely on the United States to adhere to or abide by existing rules. They'll do whatever they want, whenever they want. Well, under that circumstance, you have no incentive to hold U.S. dollars, but you also have a derivative sense of no incentive to trade in their markets either. Why would I want to participate in their metals or energy or any market if you know you can't trust the person on the other side to at least be agreement capable, right? That's how Putin puts it. He considers the West non-agreement capable, right? He's got a point, right? If the other side unilaterally renegotiates, break contracts, all of that, we wouldn't stand for that in our individual business lives. And it doesn't stand up internationally either. It's not that hard to understand. People are people. So that was a huge thing. And so we're going to see the main power centers of U.S. and I'll call it Western influence, which was London and New York, right? Those are the big power centers. That's going to wane now. And for very obvious reasons. And I'm a little bit surprised that Wall Street and Bank Street did not actually put up more of a fuss and actually try and, they should have really screamed loudly at breaking our international convention on the dollar, because so much, you know what I say about the United States, it was born on third base, but it thinks it hit a triple, right? Which is I forget who said that first, but it's pulling from that Francois Mitterrand quote of having the world's reserve currency is an exorbitant privilege. It's been a fabulous privilege. And we just toasted it without even a proper conversation. And now we're going to have to live with waking up to the idea that we born on third base, and that was a lot of fun, but that's now gone. And there's 10 to 20 trillion US dollars offshore that if those suddenly decide they don't want to be held anymore, people just aren't ready for exactly just how fast this could turn on them, I don't think.
No, I don't. And you bring up something, you know, whether we're locking people out of the SWIFT system or freezing their reserves, you know, even what was it this week or last week, Macron was in China saying, you know, maybe we need to move away from the dollar. So you have OPEC countries, Saudi Arabia, India, Russia, China. You have BRIC countries from Brazil, more and more. And what's critical here, these are countries that produce a lot of the key minerals that we need for just economic growth. But also, if we're going to transition to green and they're producing the copper and other things that we need, what are we going to do when we can't buy those in dollars?
Well, we'll try and, you know, take them militarily. We have gunboat diplomacy and China has checkbook diplomacy. Between the two, I actually think checkbook diplomacy is a winning strategy because people who like to do business with you are much easier to work with than people who feel aggrieved or put upon or abused. So I think China has the winning strategy on that front. You know, if the United States is going to get its act back together, we're going to have to clean house. We got to get rid of these neocons as sort of a catch-all term for what I'll call sort of non-serious humans who make very serious decisions and they got a lot of hubris and they just think they can punish everybody into submission. It's not a winning strategy in life, and we're seeing the effects of China wooing people and winning them over. It's you know, not that hard to understand from my vantage point. But we're going to be super sorry if we don't change course soon, because the United States, last I saw, there's about 20 things just on a resource base that we 100% are reliant on imports on. We don't make any of these core resources, right? So you have to import them, you know, cobalt, for instance. So these are just things you need. And then beyond that, you know, it's a big, giant, multipolar world now where nobody is actually manufacturing anything 100% anymore. So you have to stay on good terms with everybody. And if you trash the dollar, you break the prime agreement, right? That's what money is, not a thing, right? What we call money, currency. It's not a thing. It's a social agreement. It's an arrangement, right? And if you break the agreement, you break the social contract. That's why when you watch Venezuela descend into, you know, Mad Max territory, it's because their money system broke under them. It's why the British, you know, printed wagon loads of scrip back in the continent, you know, the Continentals back in the Revolutionary War, because they knew that if you could debase the currency, you erode the society. So we're willingly eroding our core contracts with our international friends and allies. And I just wish there was more thought put into that, because the consequences of this are not hard to foresee.
You know, I forget the quote. I think it was Winston Churchill who said that with Americans, they'll do everything wrong before they finally get it right. And it seems that's the route we're going down, because I think sooner or later, when you can't get stuff, or it's too pricey, or you can't grow your economy, or you can't get the electricity to run things, it's going to force a change, Chris. And just hopefully we can do this in time to put this, because to redo the grid, to redo the rail system in this country, to redo the shipping and barge system in this country, to reorient our energy system, whether it, as I'm in your camp, that we ought to be going more to nuclear, it's dependable, it's reliable, and you can make, China's doing this, you can make these new nuclear power plants, they can be smaller, they're less costly. But then, Chris, you're going to have to waive all this red tape and regulation that you have to go through, because good luck, even though we want to go wind and solar, I can tell you this, Chris, they're not going to be putting up wind farms offshore Santa Barbara. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah. No, I really wish we were going down this nuclear path. I wish we were exploring all the new nuclear paths that are out there, including the thorium reactors as a possibility, et cetera. There's a lot of things we could be doing. We're not. So, you know, this all sounds a little doom and gloomy, and honestly, it is for people who aren't seeing this stuff coming. There's going to be a lot of people, Jim, who are blindsided by all this. Presumably not, you know, your listeners, my followers, because we're watching this coming. We're not happy that it's coming. But listen, this will all shake itself out. In the future, there's going to be winners and losers. Maybe a few more losers this time than last time, right? Because it's that serious. But there will be winners. And the way we get there is you have to be clear-eyed about what's happening. You have to understand what the risks are. And then you have to place your bets before those risks materialize. And, you know, that's business, right? So we just have to, when the dust settles, 10 years, 20 years from now, people write the books, they look back, and they'll try the same old thing. It's like, oh, man, what a wealth destruction that was. Oh, you know, look at the middle class got wiped out, yada, yada. But that's not what happened. The real wealth is still there, right? The real wealth is the arable soil, the trees, the water, the ores, the productive factories. Those will all still be there. What will happen is who owns them is going to change. And so it'll be a wealth transfer. And there's probably going to be an overall destruction of standards of living. That may not necessarily be a bad thing if we do it, pull it off right. But I think most people just think it's they don't understand like just how much is on the line right now, and how important it is that you have a very clear sense of what's happening. And it's all uncertain, of course. You got to place your chips very carefully and strategically. And guess what? A few of those chips are going to burn, but hopefully not all of them.
In summing, Chris, I think we'd say a number of things. You know, if you're thinking about getting a car, folks, get a hybrid now while they're affordable. That's number one. If you're talking about investing in the breakdown of this system, you need to have your assets in hard assets that are going to preserve their value as the currency depreciates in value. And then the third thing, you might want to take some emergency steps. You know, Chris, I have 6 months worth of food supply. And, you know, you say that and people, you're a little crazy. Well, folks, you remember what it was like when COVID and the lockdowns first hit, when you couldn't get toilet paper, when Costco limited you to maybe one or two chickens? I mean, these are the kind of things that can happen. And rather than panic and go to hoarding when something like this erupts, and we can see that happening again, make plans to do things now so you're prepared and so you don't have to go through that panic moment. And the one thing, Chris, why don't we talk as we close? You did a crash course, something that you put together that explains a lot of this. It is really excellent, folks, if you've never read Chris's stuff. You've updated that to current conditions. So tell our listeners about that, if you would.
Well, sure. I still have to update the video products, which is happening behind the scenes right now. But I took the time last summer and I rewrote the book, The Crash Course. That's a revised edition. It actually cracked the Wall Street Journal's bestseller list there, so in business books. So I'm hoping more people had a chance to read it. And it gets great reviews because it just tells how we put economy, energy, environment, three big E's. You have to look at them from a high level point of view. And once you do, it just shows, at least to me, how things are going to change, right? And it really grounds people in the primacy of energy. It's not just a resource. No, it's the master resource. And so if you can do that, if you can put your energy goggles on, the world changes, you see everything, geopolitics makes sense. I think it's very explanatory. So that's the book, The Crash Course. But still, if you want to watch either the accelerated crash course or the full crash course, which is, I don't know, 28 chapters now, online, you can find that at peakprosperity.com or over on YouTube. Those are free, easy to watch, gives you the high level construct of what's happening here. And, you know, Jim, this is the thing I love the most, when people say, thank you for writing that, because I now see the world in a slightly different way. And I'm not asking for people to believe it or follow me or any of that. I want a robust debate. I just want people to think about it, at least enough to accept it or reject it or argue with it, because we have to have the conversation.
Well, Chris, keep up the good work. And we need more people like you getting the message out there, because you certainly aren't getting this through the mainstream media. They're just totally oblivious to all of this, and you're not getting it from politicians or Wall Street. So keep up the good work, Chris. It was a pleasure speaking with you, and I hope to do that again.
Thank you, Jim. Always a pleasure speaking with you.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.